Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel Problem Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. You want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
This is The Linux Show for Tuesday, November 19th, 2002. We've got a slightly reduced cast with us today. I'm here, Kevin Hill, and we also have with us Russ Pavlicek and Arnie Fonas. So, to kick off, did anyone get to see the meteor shower yesterday?
Yeah, I got up this morning at, this morning at 2:20 after going to hitting the sack early, and of course here we had a full moon and of course LA skies. It was very clear out. I could see Orion Nebula and Orion a little bit with a naked eye, so that's pretty clear for Inland Empire here. But I only saw a couple meteors, and last year's, where I went out to the desert, last year's was spectacular in comparison to this year's. The moon just washed out everything.
Wow. I was out there this morning as well, and last year for us, we had thick fog, and that was a bit of a problem, but we still managed to see a few bright ones coming through. But this year we had a pretty clear sky, but still I was only seeing about one every 90 seconds on average.
That's pretty typical.
Yeah, here it was cloudy all day, so I didn't really even bother looking, but then what I got up early this morning, it looked like it had cleared up, and saw a couple meteors still going by, but not a whole lot.
Well, we can all wait and see the next good one. It'll be 99 years from now.
Yeah, as long as they keep doubling the lifespan every so often, we might make it. But anyway, to kick off with the news, I see that Paul Allen's Digio company acquired Moxie, who is working on a TiVo-like PVR that is running Linux, and looks like they are about to release, although it looks like they're only going to be selling to OEM solutions like big cable companies and such. So I kind of have mixed feelings about that kind of solution. On the one hand, it's cool knowing that there's Linux inside, but when you look at what companies like TiVo are doing now, it's getting very hard to actually get in and play with the thing, which is, of course, the major appeal for me running Linux.
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of makes sense, I guess, because they're trying to build in with a lot of these things. They want a closed black box with some form of attached services where they can try to make money off the whole thing. So it makes, you know, sense from a business standpoint, but it kind of sucks from the technical standpoint sometimes, some of the decisions that they end up with. But it does look like it's an interesting box.
Oh, yeah, it'll definitely be interesting, and like I say, it'll be interesting to see people figure out how to play with it. Although, one of the things you always got to be afraid of when you do have a box that's so configurable, you have to wonder if they're going to change features down the road, not only add them, but possibly take away, as TiVo has gone back and forth on a few of their features.
Mm-hmm. Also, for people listening, you can find a write-up on this whole thing over at OS News. They got a very nice write-up with some screenshots.
Although it is interesting that Paul Allen kept up with Linux and not switch it over to embedded XP.
Embedded XP? I shudder.
Well, you know, there was a lot of speculation about that, you know, was the real reason why he kept up with it, because he simply wanted to get a box in the market. And this thing had been developed under Linux, and if they had gone back the other way, would it have ended up costing, you know, more money and time? So it just may have been a practical matter as much as anything. But, well, we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, if the next version comes out with embedded XP Plus or whatever Microsoft has down the road, then we know which way things are playing.
I wonder if the embedded XP will have the embedded blue screen of death.
Well, supposedly, well, I don't know what the exact status of it is, but I guess that's basically what the Xbox software is based on. And I guess in beta testing, it was the green screen of death.
The green screen?
No.
Yeah. I remember in my early days, green screens were in the 80s, green screens were the monochrome monitor of choice until they came out with yellow screens. And
right.
Of course, Microsoft rewrote it all to blue screens now.
Yeah.
And added the death part.
And also, I see coming out of Comdex today, SCO Linux 4 and SUSE Linux Enterprise Server 8 based on United Linux are coming out today.
Yeah, those are two very important things. The other one that I noted that's playing that game, and it seems kind of strange to me, is that Xeon has announced that they're going to be supporting United Linux, you know, through SUSE, I think, which is kind of strange because United Linux was supposed to be a server-only operating system from the way they had originally described it.
That's right.
So, you know, dun, 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 dun. Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens when you add Xeon to a server.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, although I don't imagine SUSE would have two completely different base distributions for all their various products. I know they were fairly well known for their desktop use as well, so I imagine it kind of fits.
Yeah,
SUSE's distribution is pretty good on desktop. I used it for several years.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of it. The question I have, I'd like to see whether or not you'll end up with a United Linux branded desktop before too long, because they were denying that was in the works. But you know, the way it's kind of playing now, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's certainly a good idea. It couldn't hurt to make sure various distributions are compatible. But I certainly don't think the big enterprise customers are going to say, oh, gee, this is just what we're waiting for. We can switch all our machines now.
Yeah, that's true.
Joe Barr is inimitable Joe Barr is in the chat room, and he asked the question, the rhetorical question, does Linux run on SUSE? Yeah,
hey, guys. How you doing, guys?
Hi, Doc.
Hey. It's me. I only got about a few minutes. I'm in the airport at Palm Springs between Comdex and home.
Now, why don't you take it, Joe? I mean, the Doc.
What's that?
Any big stories out of Comdex, Doc?
Well, no good ones, I'm afraid. Linux is almost invisible there. It was a Microsoft show. That's the bad news. The good news, in a weird kind of way, is that Comdex looks more irrelevant than ever. I haven't been there in 2 years, and it's a pathetic remnant of what it once was. It's kind of, there were a lot of people there, but there was not. Dell wasn't there. IBM was there supposedly, but it was off-site. I never did find them.
Wow.
HP had a pretty big presence there, but you know, they were busy showing off their, everybody who had a Windows tablet to show off was there. Fujitsu, Toshiba, and when I, you know, wearing my AOGC badge rather than my Linux badge, I went in and I tried to get various hardware companies to sell me a Linux box, and without exception they all told me to go away. It was pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. And all of the new boxes have this, you know, designed for Windows XP on them. Mm-hmm. So, pretty interesting. It closed, though, today for me at 2 o'clock with a very terrific debate between a bunch of Hollywood types, record and movie industry types, and on one side, and John Perry Barlow and Richard Stallman on the other.
Wow.
In a sound system that curiously made everybody sound like Richard.
What a wonderful thing.
I would get one of those sound systems. It was pretty funny, actually. And I was in the same debate thing yesterday, but it wasn't nearly as debatey as this one was. And it was pretty. At one point, one of the guys just said to Richard, "Will you please shut up?" Because Richard, of course, wouldn't stop talking. You know. But it was really good, and Richard was about the best I've seen him. And he was in a high snot about the things he needed to be in a high snot about, and it was good. It was a good show. So that was the one place where Linux had a presence. Other than when I was on stage the day before, but that was it, pretty much as far as I could tell. That there were huge booths for like countries, Korea and France, and China and Taiwan and England. But I mean, maybe they moved in where Dell and IBM moved out, and Apple was utterly absent as well.
Wow.
Yeah. There was a Wi-Fi section, but no war talking, which I thought would have been pretty cool. And I got on. I added a few things to my regular blog. And I had a long piece on the Linux Journal blog actually about if you go to the experimental blog link on the Linux Journal site, there's my review of the Carly Fiorina's infomercial, which was called a keynote, on yesterday, and Scott McNeely's keynote, which actually was around noon. It's pretty. I don't know. I was very disappointed by HP's thing. They're like all marketing and no substance right now. At least in terms of their marketing. Maybe you don't expect substance out of marketing. But she looked like she was running for office or something. And she didn't look happy, you know. She looked really all business, tough, you know. And Scott was just his relaxed self, you know, telling jokes. His joke about HP was, when somebody asked him about it, he said, "Well, I just somehow don't think that printing is part of your problem." It was nasty. Anyway.
Wow.
So, they're boarding my plane. So.
Okay.
You guys still there? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to get off, and I'll call you back. I'll call you again when I'm in Los Angeles. It's only a half-hour flight.
Okay.
I'm going to fly over Arnie and wave when I'm going by.
Yeah, I'll wave as you go by.
Okay, guys. See you in a bit.
Okay. Talk to you later, Doc.
Yeah, so has anybody played with any of the new tablet PCs yet?
I haven't had a chance. I was at the computer fair this last weekend, which is like almost more than once a month, and I've been going every month. And they, of course, they're more or less just pieces and parts for people who like to build computers and geeks like me. And they didn't seem to have anything like that. I mean, I didn't see any tablets there. I would like to try one, but it seems to me they're all XP, so who wants to play with XP?
Well, that does seem to be the case. I mean, they seem to be an all-in-one solution designed for XP, and one of the early raps I had heard about it was that, how the clone industry, which frankly is the major part of PC production in the world, was going to react to it. Because there isn't any, or at least from the early days, they were saying there was no real ability to clone this thing inside the same sense that you do now. So you have these dedicated manufacturers who build the completed tablets, and so none of these clone builders will have any piece of that market at all. And I know there was some early speculation about whether that would drive a lot of the clone makers over to a more Linux-based offering, simply because they wouldn't be able to play with Windows tablets.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It seems to me, and this is something I was kind of finding interesting this week, is that there are a lot of tablets on the market all of a sudden. Where did they come from? How did they come up to market so quickly? And two, you know, second of all, why are we so far behind on this one? I mean, it just seems to me that there's some entrepreneurs could have joined the fray with at least one Linux version. You know, is this going to be another one of those things where, like, laptops were locked out? And that kind of distresses me a bit. I mean, it took how long to get Linux on the Palm? And, you know, it took the Zoras to get one Linux on the Palm that worked well. And these pads are out there, and, you know, we don't have a single one.
Well, I think part of it, too, is just that Linux development is driven by what people want to support. And I think you just got to question whether people really want something that's almost as big and heavy as a laptop, but you can't type on it.
You know, this is where I'm going with this thing, because, you know, here we have all of a sudden, they're all over the place. Everybody's saying, you need this wonderful, and here we have, ViewSonic is advertising their new device, and what is their claim to fame? You can doodle on it. Excuse me? Doodle? Well, you know, don't dash your doodle at it.
That's what the doodle sketch is for.
I mean, this is not what I call a killer app. In fact, you know, maybe to my step-grandson, Sage, who's just 2 years old, that would be fine. He could doodle all he wants on it, but I don't think this is what the big businesses want, is doodling.
Well, you know, I think you did hit on an important point, though. The problem with the tablet is the same basic problem that you found with laptops, and that is that there's no such thing as a generic laptop. It is a specific box built by a specific manufacturer. Now, in the tablet world, my understanding is that Microsoft did the basis hardware design for the darn thing, and you have a few manufacturers who have now gone off and done their own implementations. But it's rather clear that the whole thing is designed for as a Windows box. And I know that there have been people within the Linux community working on trying to deal with Linux on a tablet-style device, but once again, you can't get hold of one till one hits the market.
Well, we had one on the market, 2 years ago? A little over 2 years ago. When that company was selling them for cheap, what was the name of that company who was selling them for cheap, and the Linux people were hacking them, and you know, of course they were probably a little too early, maybe, but I can't remember the name of them. I wrote an article about them. I can't remember. Well, at any rate, it shows how important they are now. Of course, they're gone, but
yeah. Well, I doubt it's the same design.
Who cares about the design? I mean, the design, the proprietary part of the design, is irrelevant. The what's important is the features like you know the touch screen and what you could do with that. And, you know, I just think that a scaled up little Zoras type of device would be fine, or just basically a basic screen with basic functionality built into it, where you could maybe plug in a keyboard, you know. A happy hacking keyboard and a flat panel would make a pretty nice little portable computer.
But the bottom line still with that is you have to have someone who's manufacturing the thing.
That's right.
And
it's got to be portable and open.
This whole thing, that's the trick. Because up until now, you know, these tablet PCs, you're going to, once again, it's the same problem that we had years ago with the laptops. You're going to have to buy it with the Microsoft operating system on it. You're going to have engineers who are going to have to, since it is proprietary hardware in a lot of ways, they have to sit down, they have to figure out various drivers and tweaks and whatnot to get the whole thing working. And it's designed to keep us behind the eight ball. I mean, you know, the whole thing from the get-go, I even saw a piece somewhere in the last few days where both Gates and Ballmer are basically saying that the PC is done for. And what's the future? The future is these tablets. Well, they sure as hell hope so.
Well, you know, this is really
funny. That's a whole bunch of proprietary things with their names all over them. That's exactly what they want.
Wait a minute. This sounds an awful lot like leveraging one's monopoly, does it not?
It could be.
I mean, we had a consent decree a few years ago about that with Microsoft, And, of course, that went by the wayside. And then, of course, we know we've had a federal case recently decided, finally. And, of course, you know, slapping the wrist and saying, go ahead and tie the tie that binds, you know. Tie to the operating system all you want. We're not going to do anything about it. And now, all of a sudden, they are leveraging their monopoly in desktops to grab this new market and own the whole thing. I mean, someone needs to say, stop, Microsoft. And apparently it's not going to be the federal government of the United States. One hopes that maybe the European Union will come in and do something nasty to the evil empire.
There have been a story about that recently, too, that there was apparently some speculation that the European Union might actually go that route. We're going to have to wait and see on that one, I think.
I hope. Because these guys need to be smacked down.
So, any other big stories this week?
Well, I have a few. Here's one. Here's just a little tidbit from Information Week. A little story in the front at the top of the week, on the top of the week page, under operating systems. Here's a promise. The article says Microsoft Server near. And apparently Microsoft is going to have a server operating system come 2003. One would hope that would be true, but maybe it isn't. I don't know.
Are they re-releasing NT 3.51 or something?
Well, this is just such tempting bait here. Windows .NET Server 2003 to be available in April following one or more release candidate. Well, you know, remember Microsoft's release schedules. And I guess he announced that Comdex this week in Las Vegas, and that was one of the big stories. Microsoft's going to have a server operating system someday. I want to hope so.
Did they actually say what that would entail?
No, it's like a three paragraph little blurb. It just says that November 17th, the server operating system will go into its final testing phase or release candidate 2 within a few weeks, with general availability planned for April. It's the first major upgrade to Microsoft's server operating system since Windows 2000. And, of course, it's got the spyware and the phone back to the mothership and all that other stuff, I guess. The software will be capable of running on up to 64 CPUs and has run up to 200% faster than Windows 2000 in some tests, says Bob O'Brien, Group Product Manager with Microsoft Windows Server Division. It'll be offered in four packages: Data Center, Enterprise, Standard, and a new edition that's optimized for websites. Pricing hasn't been set. Yada, 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 yada. So that's from Information Week. Sharp has announced the new version of the Zoris, which should be available, I believe, next year, I heard. Maybe earlier than that, though. It's the Zoris SL5600. It looks identical to the 5500, the existing Zoris, but they've added some more features to it that is good. For one thing, it's got a 400 megahertz Intel X-Scale processor instead of the strong arm. Other features include a QVGA LCD screen, integrated 3D, well, same keyboard, same screen. 64 megabytes of memory, flash memory for storage, and 32 megabytes of synchronous dynamic RAM, which is an expansion that doubles that part of the memory. Expansion slots supported compact flash and secure digital, just like the 5500. It also has a microphone in it, which is good. The version I have, 5500, doesn't have a mic, and if you want to use voice recorder, you have to get a little microphone, plug it into the earphone jack. But generally, there's some new PC synchronization software for Microsoft Outlook and some other new software features, which probably will be available for download on the 5500 as well.
Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to record without having to find something that will actually plug into the rather odd microphone jack.
Well, a bunch of people have hacked that. I mean, they've hacked a little tiny microphone and plugs in, and basically it takes not much room at all. And
the only problem I have is my wireless card sticks out a bit and blocks the headphone jack.
Oh, that's no good. Which one do you have?
The D-Link.
Oh, that's the one to have, too.
Yeah.
And speaking of strong arm, ARM in England, who is the Advanced Risk Machines, which is, I don't know if they're fabless yet, but they were always a fabless lab, CPU lab. They designed CPUs, but had no fab lab to manufacture them, and I think they're still the same mode. But they have come up with their new ARM core, and this is going geared to go head-to-head with Intel's Xscale. And the new ARM 11 includes integrated floating point, which is new. The strong arm never had floating point; did software floating point. The new arm runs at 400 megahertz, which puts it right up against Xscale. It can do 4 8-bit operations in parallel. Includes Giselle ARM's implementation of a Java 2 Micro Edition virtual machine in hardware, so it does Java and hardware, which is nice. As 8-stage pipeline and 2-cycle cache access, and apparently what they've done is some pretty sophisticated things with the cache, and they've got the memory management outside the cache, so it handles the cache, so people who are doing cache flushes in the software on the strong arm between context switches won't have to do that anymore. Kind of neat. So that looks like very promising, and if that's slated to go into production by year end, or availability for developers by year end.
Oh, cool. Any major customers announced for it yet?
No. Let's see. There was a couple people. Symbian OS, Linux, Windows CE are the three things they're going to support right away. And eventually they're going to get VxWorks and a few other things, Palm OS 5. But the first ones are going to be Linux, Symbian, and Windows CE, Wince, so people can wince about it.
Oh, cool.
And let's see, I got a couple other things, but most of them are just small, faster Mac, new notebooks attack mobile anyway with Pens, Performance, and Gasp Unix. Well, first of all, if you're going to have notebooks running Unix, first of all, you got to kill Microsoft's monopoly on installation of operating systems on laptops.
I was starting to get a little worried.
So I don't know where. This was in InfoWorld, and I don't know where they're going with that.
Mm.
If there's going to be Unix on laptops, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, that would be a good thing. I
really want to know more about it.
And that's about it for this week.
Okay, Russ, you got story of the week?
Yeah, I got a couple here. One that I think is going to be potentially one of the sleepers of the week is a piece over at ZDNet.com called Open Source CMS on the Rise. And it talks about open source content management systems, which are going up against the likes of Vignette and Interwoven. And it talks about Zope, Midgard, OpenCMS, and Red Hat CCM. The reason why I think this is going to be a more important story than the press it's getting is that this is dealing more with the high end inside established business things. You have a lot of business customers looking for just this sort of solution, and apparently the open source side of it is actually getting a straight look now, and that's excellent. That's very good news for those of us who want to see more Linux in the enterprise and more open source in the enterprise. The second piece I have for tonight, over on NewsForge, Robin Miller did a piece last Thursday called Aberdeen Group, Linux and Open Source Now Have More Security Problems Than Windows. And this one has been batted around for a few days. A number of people taking different tacks on this thing, but I haven't been able to get hold of a copy of the actual report, but I have been looking at some of the sources for the numbers, and it looks like they're just playing a straight counting game, you know, as far as incidents and whatnot. And a lot of people, you know, are wondering whether problems are being double and triple counted, as they are wont to be in the open source world. That doesn't seem to be so much the issue,
But I think that I think the aggregation is more the issue here, because I'm looking at a lot of these warnings that are going up that on the open source side, they're actually pretty limited. You know, it depends on what you've installed on the machine, and a lot of these warnings just won't apply to a lot of people. And what's more, a lot of these warnings won't apply if you're using a distribution. They're only going to apply if you're going to be upgrading directly from the source on the supplier's website, and not too many people do that. I mean, there are some, obviously, but most people in production are working from, you know, Red Hat or Mandrake or SUSE or whatever, and a lot of the vulnerabilities actually seem to be fixed by the time they get to the distribution. So I think that there's a lot of interesting use of numbers through this, where the picture may appear to be one thing, but I think if we actually did an analysis of how many systems were suffering as a result of all of this, the conclusions would be quite different than what this report is coming up with. And this one's just doing a simple, almost brain-damaged head count of problems, and not an analysis of how many machines are really at risk here.
I think the words brain damaged is awfully appropriate. For instance, I have just since the 11th received 8 security alerts from Debian. And Debian's better than most at getting these things out in a timely manner. And maybe in the last 8 days, that's a lot. One of them was Apache Perl, which I run. One was Bind, which I run. But the rest of them, in Apache Perl and Bind, don't have security alerts every day. But, you know, it took me basically, the Bind thing was supposedly, in ZDNet and in eWeek made a big deal about this. This last week, about the bind the domain name service weakness. However, the weakness wasn't a weakness because basically within the same day there was a update on the Debian security site, and I basically did an apt-get and it was done. I just brought, you know, and it, I didn't even have to bring down my bind server; it automatically restarted it when I installed it. The last one I received was Monarch, M-H-O-N-A-R-C. Now, Monarch is a great little utility for sorting and making reports and building websites based on mail list archives. And if you have an archive site, a mailing list on your web server, chances are good you might use Monarch. Well, this is a utility, an end user utility. It doesn't it's not something that's running as a server. And I just can't imagine, I don't run it. I have it, I don't run it very often, but because I don't have any mailing list. But if you have a mailing list, you might use this. But how many people use Monarch to sort their mailing list archives? Not very many, I would suggest. And there, I imagine they are counting this as one of Linux's liabilities. Linux has a weakness, and here it's not in Linux at all. It's this Monarch thing.
And can anybody match the poll in IE that was announced that lets remote websites format users' hard drive?
Yeah. these guys in the Aberdeen group were paid by Microsoft to lie through their teeth and create this sham, faux bunch of pack of lies, and you know, this is just marketing. It's just lies, you know, and more lies, you know.
Well, you know, a lot of it is that there are numbers there to support the fact that there are numbers there.
Yeah, there's numbers there for sure.
It's the question of how you interpret the numbers, and part of the problem with the aggregation too is that when you start talking about problems with open source, well, you're talking about thousands upon thousands of packages.
Yeah.
A lot of which may not be running at all on your
By the way, Debian now is up to 9,000. And that's a lot of packages. And how many? They're all counting against Linux now because Aberdeen Group says they're all Linux.
Yeah, it's you know, I think a more apples to apples sort of thing. If you're going to compare open source to Microsoft, then suddenly I think you'd have to like even factor in problems with the Xbox, you know, on the Microsoft tally, because the lines of demarcation in the closed source world tend to be rather clear. They have to be, because each one's a product, and so you can break it off as to what, you know, where this product starts and where that product ends. The problem, of course, though, in the open source world is that you know, it's gigantic. It is it covers far more. I mean, a problem with Linux could be with open Office software. It could be with server software. It could be, you know, it could be the thing that that downloads pictures from your camera. But all, you know, GPhoto or something like that. But all three of those would be separate products in the closed source world. Maybe even separate manufacturers, depending. And so it's almost not a. You know, you have a very hard time breaking off one from another. It would take a very intelligent analysis of numbers to try to determine, you know, an apples-to-apples comparison rather than an apples-to-oranges. And I think that's what we have as much as anything, is an apples-to-oranges comparison.
That's right. I have a security alert last week on Squirrel Mail. Excuse me, are they counting that as a Linux? Those squirrels at Aberdeen are probably counting Squirrel Mail as a Linux liability. I mean, how many people use Squirrel Mail, for Christ's sake?
Yep. Well, any more stories for the week, Russ?
Just one quickie, and that is, of course, if folks didn't see it on Slashdot on Sunday, is the Microsoft Profit and Loss by Business Area story that's actually carried over at the Register. And the bottom line on that is basically they make tons of money off of Office. They make tons of money off the Windows operating systems, and they're having, you know, they're not making money anywhere else, really, is what it comes down to. So you have the two areas where they have been accused of having monopoly power, which somehow is leveraging everything else that they're doing. Surprise, surprise. So it's an interesting read. And worth going over there and taking a look. That's it for me.
Okay, well, I guess on that note, we'll take a short break. So kick back, listen to this tune, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms. Inside my dreams.
And we're back. This is the Linux Show, and for the second half, we are joined by Joshua Haar, CTO of Linux Networks. Welcome to the Linux Show.
Thanks.
Well, Joshua, can you tell us a little bit about what Linux Networks is and what your line of business is?
Sure. We started out as a company that actually made high-performance board-level products in the early 90s. And then in 1997, we shipped what I think was the first commercially available Linux cluster to a couple of the national labs. And that business has grown, and that is now all we do. We build high-performance supercomputers based on Linux.
Oh, that's
using Beowulf.
Using a Beowulf-like architecture.
Okay, so it's a variety then of the Beowulf concept.
Well, Beowulf is there's no Beowulf software per se.
Right.
The Beowulf architecture is supposed to be all commodity off-the-shelf equipment.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes use interconnects or storage that it would probably be a stretch to call it commodity equipment. So that strict use of the word Beowulf is sometimes debated because of that. But it's Linux and it's Intel processors, so it's pretty close.
Well, one of the reasons why we asked you on this time is because there was a nice story over at Slashdot on Sunday talking about machines, Linux clusters, that have finally broken the teraflop barrier. And right up there on top, we see Lawrence Livermore's MCR, built by Linux Networks, ranks number 5 in the top 500.org listing for supercomputers. And then the Argonne National Labs one that you did comes in at number 46. Congratulations on some great showing there, number one. That's terrific to see. What sort of uses are these particular machines going for, or is that classified and they'd have to kill us if...
No, actually, there are classified machines, but neither of these two machines are. There's actually a third machine that we didn't quite make onto the list that's would probably rank around number 10 on the list. It's over 1,000 nodes as well. And these machines are all being used for slightly different things. The Livermore machine is what they call a production machine. So this is something that they will have literally hundreds of users logging into from various government sites and running a wide variety of codes on, and it's expected to have very good reliability and professional management capabilities, and so that's sort of the highest bar is a true production machine. The Argonne machine is a similar machine at a smaller scale for a smaller group of users, and then the Los Alamos machine, which it's 1,024 nodes that didn't quite make it on there, that's a different kind of machine. That's a purely R&D machine. So this is a large system that people doing operating system research especially can use to sort of do cutting-edge work. We've worked with them on Linux BIOS on this kind of a project before, and we're doing some really neat things architecture-wise with that machine, and we get to have a little fun with it because it's not a production machine. It's okay if it breaks every now and then.
Mm. Tell me, are you seeing more uses for these machines as you're putting them in? I mean, are your customers looking at new ways of using them rather than, you know, the things that we would normally associate with Beowulf-style clusters?
Well, there's a couple answers to that. I guess in the strictly high-performance computing area, which is where most of our systems go in, Probably the biggest news is that people are actively porting their code to this kind of an architecture. So, for example, the Boeing Delta IV rocket, which was recently made public and should launch here in the next couple of weeks, that was designed with one of our, the aerodynamics of that were designed with one of our systems. And we have a number of other companies that are doing things like crash testing and things like simulations for various industrial processes using these machines. So the code base in the high-performance world is quite broad now for these Linux clusters, and it's expanding rapidly.
I cited an article last week, on the Linux show, on crash testing in Linux, or was it the week before last, one of the two. And it seems like that it's another niche that Linux is grabbing, and maybe because of Linux networks, huh?
Yeah, let me tell you about a deal that we've been working with recently that we think is very exciting. There's a company that nobody's ever heard of probably called Magma. They're based in Germany, and they make high-end software for simulating casting, metal casting. And they have a customer called Nemac. Nemac makes all of the engine heads for cars sold in North America, American cars in North America, as well as all of the engine blocks for Ford. And we were able to, they had a legacy supercomputer in there, and we were able to cut their simulation time from 10 days to 8 hours and at half the budget. And what this meant for them, they were generating $1 million of scrap metal a week, and we were able to cut that drastically because of increased turnaround times on those systems. So this is an example where it made a difference to their bottom line by using this kind of a system.
Did that cost include purchasing the new machine?
Yeah. In fact, they got an ROI on that. They got a full return on their investment in that machine within 6 weeks of buying it.
Oh, my gosh.
That's impressive.
Yeah,
I say if they bought the new machine then and amortized it over a few weeks, it's paid for.
Yeah, we told them that they should just buy another one every 6 weeks.
I'll tell you, that is amazing, because I can remember years ago I worked for a very large newspaper chain, and we went through ROI justifications for getting hardware, and there was an expression in that business that when you make your money a nickel at a time, you don't let go of it too quickly.
Yeah.
And even there, if you could come up with an ROI figure that came in at under 18 months, where you were getting return, positive return in under 18 months, generally they would rubber stamp the purchase, because it was well worth it at that point if they could get the money back that fast. When you're going from 18 months down to a few weeks, That is just amazing.
Yeah, they're very happy. They're buying more systems, and Magma, the software company, they're very happy and are evangelizing these systems now. It's been a very good thing all the way around for everybody, I think.
What would you say are the essential components that you use inside one of your clustered solutions? You've mentioned that they have a standard Intel, series of processors. But what other things would you expect to see on a Linux networks cluster?
It really depends on the customer, and I'll try not to dodge the question completely, but it really depends on their application. So let me give you a couple of examples and what we would provide to customers in different scenarios. So a lot of the a lot of, for example, the national labs run very large simulations, and they truly use the cluster as a single machine, meaning they run a single application across the entire machine. And for these kinds of uses of a cluster, you want a network that has high bandwidth, but even more importantly than the bandwidth, you want very low latency. And latency is not something that we worry too much about in the internet world, but it's of critical importance in a cluster because you are effectively using that interconnect the same way that you would use a memory bus in a large shared memory machine. So that's a critical component of some of the larger and more expensive machines. On the smaller machines, depending on the kind of application, we often sell with regular Ethernet. So, for example, we have a number of customers who do seismic simulations, oil and gas companies, and most of them have written their applications so that they don't require that kind of an interconnect, and they're mostly pretty happy with 10100 Ethernet.
Hmm.
And again, there are some applications where different CPU architectures will work better than an alternative. And so one of the services that we provide is that we have what we call a solution center, where we have just about every architecture and every interconnect you can possibly think of. And we help people figure out which architecture is going to work best for their application.
So there's a lot of variability then involved in the solutions that you come up with.
Yeah, huge amount.
Oh. I'm interested in the weather computers.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, tell us a little bit more about what you're doing there.
Okay. Well, this is another, actually, maybe the best place to start here is the computer that's currently ranked number one in the world, which is the Japanese so-called Earth Simulator. It's vastly faster, faster than anything else on the planet right now. And the goal of that machine is to be able to model the climate of the entire Earth at a resolution of, I believe, 20 kilometers. So they want to be able to have a grid of 20 kilometers wide spread across the entire globe and be able to model the weather of the Earth dynamically at that resolution. So that's gargantuan.
I know the technique played with that at Boeing when I was at Boeing. What do they call it? The technique for
fluid dynamics?
No, lots of cells.
lots of cells.
Yeah.
Cells are little squares.
Finite element analysis. Thank you.
Yes, there you go. Yeah,
that's incredible. I mean, a 20-kilometer square, well, they probably use shaped cells, spherical symmetry. How many would there be in the atmosphere at 20-kilometer square? That's incredible. It's an unbelievable number.
Yeah, it's huge. People sometimes think, oh, what's going to happen when the computers get fast enough? But I think it's at least in high performance computing and simulations, there'll probably never be fast enough.
Mm, no. Where do you see this going?
Linux clusters?
For your company specifically.
Well, we believe we are the leaders in high performance computing on the Linux architecture. At least we've done, I think, the most large machines and have the largest Linux machine. What we're interested in from where we are now is, I guess there's a couple things. One is we're interested in expanding the applications of the architecture. we believe that the clustered architecture is actually the basis for the server of the future.
Mm-hmm.
A cluster inherently to its architecture has incremental scalability and built-in fault tolerance, because you have separate instances of an OS and you have separate pieces of hardware. So if the software is written correctly, you should just be able, when you lose a server, it shouldn't be a loss of service. It should just be an incremental loss of capacity. And the fact that you can do this all on x86 and save a lot of money over your mainframe, we think is a compelling basis for a server architecture. And in fact, if you look at prototypical mission-critical application, which is a database, all three of the high-end databases all run on a clustered architecture. So that's Oracle 9i, DB2, and Teradata's systems. A lot of people haven't heard of Teradata, but they're actually at the very highest end. They have Walmart as their customer. And all three of those run right now on a clustered architecture on x86 hardware. And we believe that that will expand to include a wider breadth of enterprise and mission-critical applications. So that's one thing that we see happening. And related to that, we're very interested in doing some interesting things at the operating system level that will help us to get to that kind of an architecture where you can have a true single system image and the kind of fault tolerance that I described.
Would you be looking to do that as a real open source project, or is that going to be some sort of closed add-on? Do you have any vision of that point?
Yeah, well, we're open source advocates. We are currently working with the government to try to get the right kind of funding to do this work, but the kind of work that we're talking about is something that in practice couldn't be done any other way. I mean, it's not something you could draw.
It almost has to be peer reviewed, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, maybe I can talk a second about the Linux BIOS work that we've done.
Sure, go for it.
Linux BIOS is actually a BIOS based on Linux. It initializes all of your hardware, your memory, your CPU, your North Bridge and South Bridge and whatnot. And the inspiration for the idea came from two things. First, that proprietary BIOSes seem to be very buggy and that can be very annoying. But beyond the fact that they're frequently buggy, they're not remotely manageable. And the state of the art now in proprietary BIOSes is that if you get the right system, you might be able to set your BIOS via a serial connection.
Hmm.
And in a situation where you've got 1,000 or more headless servers, that's not a real great great way to go through a serial connection on all 1,000 machines.
That's right.
I can just imagine the guy taking the serial terminal, ADM3A terminal, and plugging the serial port into each one of 1,000 machines to update the BIOS.
Yeah.
Arnie, that sounds like the grand nightmare right there.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I wonder how many listeners know what an ADM3A is. I mean, but
you're showing your age just like me. I know exactly what it is.
Well, it could be worse. It could be a KSR-33. I mean, of course, then it wouldn't be serial port. It would have to be a five bit. What do they call it?
Bordeaux.
Yeah. So that difficulty combined with the fact that Linux does all of its, for the most part, all of its own hardware setup, we thought, well, let's just see what we can. Let's try to expand the capabilities of Linux a little bit and grow it down into the hardware, and see if we can build a BIOS out of it. So. we got our first running instance of that about 2 years ago, I guess, a little over 2 years ago. And now all three of these Teraflop class systems are all running Linux BIOS. So this is a fully functional BIOS, sits in the ROM, displaces the normal proprietary BIOS. It's fully remotely manageable over the network. It has the side effect that it boots extremely quickly. From cold power on to the OS is less than, or to the bootloader, I should say, is less than 3 seconds.
That's good.
Yeah, and in fact, we don't know why proprietary BIOSes are as slow as they are. We actually spent about a week, about a year ago, to try to figure out, and our best guess is that it comes from obfuscation of the proprietary BIOS trying to cover up what it's doing.
You know, it's interesting. It's of course, has to, by any BIOS has to be written in assembler or machine language.
That's an interesting observation that actually isn't. We do one of the neat things about Linux BIOS is we take a kind of a radical approach to things. The first thing we do is set up the serial console before we do anything else. So even before we initialize memory. So if you get a problem initializing memory, you actually see the errors on the serial port, which is kind of a novel thing that you don't get from a proprietary BIOS. In other words, what this means in practice is that you don't have to look up 30 different beep codes to know what's happening on your machine. You actually get a text message out of your serial port.
Hey, all you have to do is connect the ADM3A to it, and you got it.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, too, if you're a real geek, you don't have to look up the beep codes. You got them memorized, right?
Yeah. And in addition to that, once memory set up, the rest of the BIOS is written in C. In fact, on some processor platforms, our technical lead on this has done something truly geeky. He has actually set up a stack in cache and set up the memory in C. And our philosophy there is that just that you want to do as much in C as you can. For maintainability.
Yeah.
Linux BIOS, and now this is something that we can call production. It's running on three of the largest systems in the world, and people really love it. And we've been able to get good cooperation from the chip vendors, since that means that they get to move a lot of extra stuff if they can help us out with some of the chipset documentation, and it's starting to get picked up by some of the chip vendors as well, by VIA and SIS and some of the others. So that's exciting.
That is exciting.
Well, this is an interesting question. It boots in 3 seconds. How often do you boot a supercomputer?
Actually, that's not an entirely academic question. It's more often than you would think. It's probably
that's true.
It's probably totally depends on the system. But
I mean, if you got
once a month isn't probably an unreasonable number.
I imagine you boot individual machines more often, though.
Yes.
And for that purpose, the fast boot would be very, very desirable.
There's actually a twist on booting one of these machines. It's actually more than the sum of its parts, and the reason for that is that the networks that we tend to use, especially on the larger machines, are all source-routed networks. So that means that the adapter knows the route to every other card in the system, and that mapping all has to be done at boot time. So this isn't an architecture where your switch can, where you have a dumb adapter and your switch is the smart one that does all the routing.
Every station has all the intelligence.
Right, and the switch is dumb in this situation, and the switch just, the adapter just says, I'm going to go in this port, and I just want you to direct my message to that port, and that's all the switch does.
Okay, because there were some questions out on IRC about, you know, how can the BIOS set up a network? You know, does it have its own embedded IP stack?
NetWinder does that.
We may do that in the future. Right now, what we do is we use Etherboot. So once we set up the system, we use Etherboot, and we actually have a multicast enabled Etherboot now, so that we actually can boot these 1,000 node systems. I don't know the number on the MCR system. That's the big one, the biggest one. But it's a remarkable time, a boot time. So that's how we're booting. Is we generally boot over the network via this multicast enabled Etherboot.
Hmm. Another question that came out of IRC too is people were asking earlier what type of Fortran compiler you're finding that your customers are using for their work.
It varies. The two most popular compilers are the Intel compiler and the compiler from Portland Group, or the PGI compilers.
Hmm.
Those are the two most common vendors. The GNU compiler, unfortunately, is a little behind in Fortran.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff that's taken place in recent years in Fortran.
Yeah, believe it or not.
Yeah, it's kind of wild because I know a lot of us, especially, you know, a little gray in the temples, you say the word Fortran, you think you know what you're talking about, but, you know, we see some of the things that have come out with the Fortran 90, Fortran 95, and so forth specs. It's a whole new world going under the name of Fortran these days.
Yes, it is. And it's very much Fortran, for those listeners not familiar with this industry, Fortran is amazingly alive and well.
You mean they got rid of the punch cards already? The 80 column term was always 80 column, and column 7 was the continuation column.
Now, Arnie, are you still using punch cards?
Yeah,
right,
I got my
ADM3A there inside your office.
Yeah, I've got my KSO33 here, and I also have a OT23 key punch.
Okay.
Try to remember that one.
Oh, yeah, sign of the times. Are there other particular open source projects that that you folks have been dealing with inside the last few years?
Sure. There's a couple. One that we just started working on and one that we'll be working on here in the very near future. One of the projects we're working on is something called SLURM. Stands for Simple Linux Utility for Resource Management. SLURM is a joint project with one of the national labs. Will be distributed under the GPO. And it's designed to be what we call a resource manager. Resource managers are responsible for sort of coordinating the remote jobs that you have running on all the nodes with some kind of host or master node that's kind of in control. So the resource manager might be responsible for distributing the jobs, starting it up across all the nodes, and keeping track of the PIDs and sending signals back and forth from the master to the compute nodes. And so we felt that there wasn't a
very
sound like Doc is back on the line here. Let's keep going.
Hi guys.
But
trying to keep quiet.
That will be all open source. And then another exciting project is actually a file system that's being sponsored by a company called Cluster File Systems. It's there's a number of core kernel developers working on it, actually. And it's federally funded. And it's designed, it's kind of got a colloquial name, which is the Intergalactic File System, or IGFS. And that's actually a good name because it aims to be the the end-all, be-all of massively parallel file systems.
Wow.
Yeah, the machine that runs is going to be called Deep Thought.
Yeah. And that's running on this MCR system that we ship. It's very much interactive development, but it's an extremely ambitious development effort. But it should be very good, and that's all under the GPL. So.
Quite cool. Let me see. So your business model to support all this then is a question of hardware and services, and most of the software is open source. Is that the way you go about things?
Yeah. So we sell complete solutions. That includes we sell hardware, and there's support contracts that go along with that. We also typically do things like an on-site install.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have software. We have some software that is open source, which I've talked about, and we have some management software that is not currently open source, so we sell that.
Mm-hmm.
And together, these systems, when you sell a solution, as opposed to just the hardware or just the software, you can realize some extra benefit or profit margin from selling that way, and so that's what we leverage. And something that I might add that's exciting to us that we've seen recently is customers very much want open source, and vendors sometimes have a difficult time putting a lot of resources into open source because the realization of revenue from that is less straightforward than printing a proprietary EULA and a CD and whatnot. So, for example, the Slurm development, development effort was all paid for by a customer as part of a system. And so that makes everybody happy. Customers happy, they get open source software. We're happy because, you know, we get paid right up front for it. So that's a great business model that we're encouraging, and we're seeing buy-in from customers on that.
Another question that's out there on IRC, basically some people want to know why would you pick Linux networks? I mean, why are your customers coming to you rather than some of the other competitors that are out there in the field?
Sure, there's a couple of things. One is that we provide and have expertise behind a number of products or technologies that are key to building a system, especially as you start getting into larger systems. So we talked about Linux BIOS. So our form factor that we sell the clusters is the densest. You can pack more servers into the same space than any of the competitors that you can get a high-speed interconnect into. So something besides Ethernet. So that's another thing. We also make a management appliance called Icebox, which I haven't talked to yet. This is a hardware appliance that runs embedded Linux, and it's also all three of these teraflops. It lets you do central power control and environmental monitoring. And we sell this management software that has very powerful multicast capabilities. You can image machines. We can image 256 machines in less than 5 minutes from bare metal. And,
wow.
So we have a lot of products that help you to build a usable cluster, something that you put it together and you're not going to have to spend all your time working out the problem. So that's one thing. And then I think the second thing is really the... we've been doing this longer than anybody else in the industry, and we have a lot of expertise behind these systems. So, for example, we have people whose main job is just to go out and make sure that your air conditioning and power are going to support the cluster so you don't wind up with a rude support when you move it this into a machine room and find out that your power has the wrong amperage coming in, not enough power, and you've got enough AC. We have a bunch of great EE guys that can debug just about any problem that you can think of. We had we once shipped a system that showed a single floating point error every 3 days.
Wow.
So it's like pretty much about the worst possible kind of problem you can think of. And we got out the oscilloscopes and we debugged that thing for probably a week, and it came down to a single batch of bad memory from a particular vendor. Anyway,
on one machine?
What's that?
On one machine?
No, but it was on just a few chips interspersed through the machine.
No,
and on average,
amazing.
It would show up about one every 3 days. And something that's very unclear, though, is why, and so this would generate multi-bit ECC errors, which can't be corrected, that aren't supposed to happen. And it was not clear why an ECC error would show up as a floating point error. But anyway, so we have a lot of expertise to help customers and to give them the assurance that we can deliver machines that work and we can fully support the machines, even though it might be, Intel's processor or other commodity hardware. We can fully stand behind it and make sure customers aren't going to buy junk.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you have, say, a 1,000-node machine and you go to try to install the thing, what sort of timeline does that take between the time that you move the boxes into place and the time when it actually does something useful for the customer?
I guess that depends if you're talking about one of our systems or someone else's. If with one of our systems, we have these tools that let you configure a kernel and the various major subsystems that are part of an image, and then, like I said, we can move that out on 256 nodes in less than 5 minutes. On MCR, which is 1,100 nodes, I think it took about 12 minutes. So it takes considerably longer to just physically put the machines in place than it does to install the software.
Wow.
But that's not the usual case. But ordinarily, there are some great. I'm going to put a plug in there for some non-Linux networks, open source tools. There are some. There's a tool called System Imager. The fellow who is the main force behind that is now working at one of the national labs, and that's a good product for a modest sized system or one that you want to build yourself. So there's some, and that's called System Imager. So there's some good tools out there in the open source domain as well.
How was Linux Network started? This is from the IRC. It doesn't sound like an ad hoc startup.
No, Linux Networks actually started in 1989, and for you guys who go back on hardware, we actually started out building transputers.
Oh, there you go.
Wow.
And we've built a lot of unique high-performance board-level products. We built some of the first gigabit Ethernet adapters, and we built them in a PMC format, and we built an alpha board on the compact PCI form factor, which I think was probably the only one that was ever built. We're the only ones cleaning up to try to put an alpha on a compact PCI board. And that was a 20-layer. That was a 20-layer board in 1989.
Wow.
That was a monster. So we have we come from a board level background.
What was Linux Network's name prior to this? That wasn't always the name of the corporation, right?
No, right. It was changed to Linux Network in 2000 from Alta Technology.
That's right. Okay.
Okay. I know who you are then.
Yeah, that's us.
Alta used to make some interesting little cubes that were used to build clusters at one point, right?
Yes. They were our alternative to a 19-inch rack at one point. They were called the Alta Cluster.
Right. I remember. I used to see you folks inside some of the Linux shows in the 90s.
Yes. Yep. Those were the first clusters were shipped in those cubes.
Have your attention in the boarding area. The bus is showing on
your I'm boarding already.
It's not me. I'm trying to cover the thing up. Again, I wish I had a kill button, but I don't.
Well, at least you know what to get on your next cell phone, Doc. Well, that pretty much runs my gamut of questions. Anyone else here on the panel have anything to ask?
Doc?
No, I'm a listener off and on. The one thing I was going to suggest is, because I came in late on this thing, is any fun statistics, some of which I just think I heard, send them to me, and I'll throw them into the LJ index we put in front of Linux Journal.
Okay.
And I'm doc at SSC.com or doc at Searles.com, either one.
That'll be great. Some of the statistics on our on these machines that we just put in are pretty amazing. So we'll send you some of those. And
or yeah, you can find Doc just by typing Doc into Google.
Yeah, number 2 after the Department of Commerce, but that may not get you to an email address. You just go to the Linux Journal site and hunt around. You'll find it there. It's pretty well published.
Out on IRC, there's a question as what is your thoughts on IBM Grid?
I don't know about IBM's Grid in particular, but we think that grids are have a very bright future. They're evolving in much the way the Internet itself evolved, starting with scientists and national labs. Building something for themselves that on protocols that were well designed but never intended to be used for the wider good, but those are expanding out of the labs now, and we think they have a bright future. We're building our systems to be grid compatible so that you can plug them into the grid.
Okay. Well, it looks like we're running late, Kev.
Yeah, we are a bit past 9 o'clock, but it's been a very interesting discussion. I would like to thank Joshua for joining us this week and everybody.
Thanks a lot. This was a great thing.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for coming. And a slight programming note, since I personally am moving and the broadcast equipment is in my house, we are not going to have a show next week, but we will be back after that, and as always, feel free to check out the archives. On behalf of the whole Linux Show team, good night, everybody, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Great.
Good night.
So you need an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? Well, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.